the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sunny as only she can, and Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny on the Tonight Show." On this Monday, August 7th, there is good news and there is bad news. The good news is Trump took a vacation. The bad news is it's a short one. More good news, though, is that as we speak, the CIA is releasing previously secret documents about John Kennedy's murder, which I don't believe will be anything other than an interesting distraction. But the further really good news is that our film, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, with only your word of mouth in just 3 weeks, has had nearly 2,000 views and growing. Now, for those of you who have sent me messages asking how you can see part one of the Garrison tapes, you can see it free on my site. Just go to YouTube/ John Barber's World, and it's there. The very, very sad news for me, though, is that Jim Mars, who made major contributions to all three of my films and to the truthful history of John Kennedy's public execution, died a couple of days ago. I posted that, to paraphrase Mark Twain, Jim would rather go to hell where the company is better than to heaven where the weather is better. But if there is a heaven, his sweet soul will be quickly transported through the pearly gates, and God will have someone very interesting to listen to. One of the upsetting, very frequent comments, though, about his demise, everyone said it was a loss to the JFK research community. Folks, it is not a community. It has never been a community. It is a gaggle of the most selfish, enormous egos and pettiest cheapskates I've ever met, more so than I ever encountered in the Hollywood community. Fortunately for us in history, Jim Mars was not one of them, and his death shows that the future in America is not what it used to be. If you've been in Vegas recently, most people are not struck by the size of the casinos as they are by the size and number of huge billboards advertising a cure for erectile dysfunction. It seems in America today, millions of even younger men are suffering from erectile dysfunction, while our no longer existing democracy suffers from electoral dysfunction. Males suffering erectile dysfunction, pardon me, never get screwed, but with electoral dysfunction, all of us get screwed. In the second half of tonight's show, we will talk about the latter part of this with Joe Satilli. But with our first lively, articulate, very bright first guest, we may touch on the former. She is a very successful sex, marriage, and addiction therapist and counselor in Los Angeles. Not only does she have the credentials, a PhD from the Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality, and a master's in clinical psychology from Antioch, she has a lifetime of struggle and achievement. I am very, very proud to say my daughter-in-law and author of her recent book, Sex and Sobriety, Dr. Annadel Barber. Annadel, thank you so, so much for being here, and how are you?
I'm great. Thank you, John, for just a fantastic introduction, actually.
Listened to my show at all, and I know that you're probably too busy to do that, is that all of the guests that I have on that I really like and admire, especially their work, the very first question I always ask is I want to know how they became the people that I like and whose work I admire. So I have to ask you, could you tell us to begin with a little bit about your background, about where you were born, the kind of parents you had, your siblings, and what it is that you wanted to do when you were a younger girl, what you dreamed about being as you got older? Did that change? And how on earth did you end up becoming a successful sex and addiction therapist?
Okay, well, okay, I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. I have an identical twin sister, by the way. And I also have a little sister. She's younger than I am, and she has a different father. So my mother and father were both born in the Deep South, so my twin and I were born in the Deep South, but they came out here when we were very young to Hollywood. And you know, my father was the alcoholic in the family, alcoholic actor, and my mother was worked in a burlesque club in Hollywood called the Pink Pussycat. And so my childhood was filled with drinking and dancing and, you know, nightlife, even before I knew there was a difference between daylife and nightlife, actually. So, seriously. You know, just somewhere along the way, my father died of alcoholism. My mother remarried. That's how I got the little sister. And then he died. And so when I was 17, I moved back to Hollywood from the Valley. And after working in banks and things like that, I pursued what I wanted to do, which was acting. And so I was fairly a little bit successful, especially with my twin sister. I was on Cheers and China Beach and My Two Dads and did commercials. And then my addiction and alcoholism just started to take over. And so my sister and I didn't work together because I was really just getting too much into all of that.
How old were you when you started to drink? And when you were drinking, did you think you were emulating your father?
I wasn't trying to emulate my father, but I did know that I drank a lot. By the time I was like 19 or 20 years old, I was already could have been trying to get sober because I was happy houring my dinners and drinking my lunches. I was dating a drug dealer, and so I kept a half a kilo of cocaine in the bank.
Oh, my God.
You know, it was things like that. And it was just a crazy life. And so I did not get sober for many years. So I just drank and did a lot of drugs and tried to act and had a lot of different jobs. Never got past high school for an education, and then I got sober at the age of 40.
And oh, so, my goodness gracious. Well, for somebody with such, I would have to describe it as an erratic or rather disturbing background. How did you have, and now I have to bring up my son, who was probably, I've met three geniuses in my life. One was Jim Garrison, one was the scientist Buckminster Fuller, and the other happens to be my son. And
yes.
He is not only enormously bright, but if you would describe somebody as sort of straight-laced and well-balanced, it would be my son. Now, how on earth did somebody with that background meet somebody like my son? And then after that, what was it that was in you that made you decide that you were going to go to Antioch and you were going to pursue this new dream that you have that you've achieved very quickly and very successfully?
Yes. I met your son many years ago when my drinking started to take off. And so that's what he and I had two dates, and then that we remember. And he's a bit younger than I am. And then I thought he was a square, actually, at that time. And that was in 1994. And then we ran into each other again in 2004, and I was sober. And when I ran into him, I went to say hello, and he asked if I was married, and I said no. And so he seemed quite surprised and happy about that. And he asked me if I had ever been to Vermont, and I asked him the restaurant of the state. And he said, well, either. And I said, I've never been to either. And he said, well, do you want to go? And I said, to the restaurant or the state? And he said, either, but how about the restaurant first? And that's how our first date happened. And then we've been together ever since, from 2004 till now. So,
well, I must tell you, one of the most beautiful things I ever heard in my life is when the two of you got married and Christopher asked me to speak at your wedding. And by the way, if you folks are interested, you can Google John Barber speaks at his son's wedding. And there is Annadelle, who is absolutely beautiful. But she pulled out of her purse or out of her pocket a memo that she had written to herself, I think about 10 years earlier, describing the kind of man that she would like to meet in her life. And it brought tears to my eyes because she said, I met him and I'm marrying him. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, when I got sober, and I started working the 12 steps, and I just started to become a different person. I started to like myself better and things like that. And part of the process was to be honest with what you wanted in things. And so I was frustrated, and someone asked me to write down everything I wanted in a relationship. Because I didn't know how to have relationships. I had many broken ones. And so I wrote it all down, and then she told me to just save it. And so I put it in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, stick it in a page, page 69, actually, which is where all the sex stuff is in the book. So Bill Wilson's pretty funny. So I stuck it there. And then after I met Chris, and we started dating, I was working with someone in sobriety. And I opened my big book and found that. And I started reading it. And it was written exactly to the day I was reading it, a year before. And so I was reading it, and it was Chris. And so that's why I pulled it out of from between my breasts, actually, in the wedding. To read it. So that's where that came from.
Well, it is just then, absolutely beautiful. Okay, now you get married. You're obviously a very, very talented actress, and you're obviously extremely attractive. So did you decide that you were not going to pursue this because it was too hectic a living to pursue, or because of you had been in touch with sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous, you felt that you could better serve people because you had been through it and survived it, and now that you could help others do that rather than entertain them by being on the screen?
Well, you know, I was pursuing it, but, you know, if you're not famous already, if you pass a certain age in Hollywood, you don't get a lot of work. And I had been helping people. And so I really was inspired by the women that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had the opportunity, I wasn't working, to, you know, I just enrolled in a school just to see if I could get my bachelor's degree, and Antioch took me, so I started going to school, and as I kept going there, I just went on to get a master's degree, and as I was studying psychology, this was the thing that they do not really cover in school. They do not cover addiction, and they do not cover sexual issues, and they certainly don't cover them in combination with each other. And so that's why I had the need, while I was getting my master's degree, to continue with a further expanded education about sexology. Because I knew from my experience and working with other people, not just women, but men. Once we get sober, our experiences of sex have been colored by substances for so many years, and there are so many fears, and there could be dysfunctions, and there could be physical damage, and there's just a disconnect from the head and the body. And so I thought it was important to study that and get an education in that as well, so I could, as a psychologist, help people in recovery with their sexual fears.
You mentioned that in the schools they don't teach you about addiction or sexuality. Well, let's get to the business of addiction first, because that's your profession. Do you think alcoholism is more prevalent in society than we're led to believe? Do you think drug addiction is more prevalent than alcoholism? And is illegal drug addiction worse than prescribed drug addiction?
Well, I think those are not truly measurable answers, because people hide their addictions, and a lot of people can get sober and then not stay sober, so the numbers can get muddy. But my experience right now, there are more people that are alcoholics than will admit. We don't like to admit it. And prescription drug addiction is so prevalent in this country that it has actually become more expensive to be a prescription drug abuser than a street drug user. And so now the heroin deaths, I just saw a report this morning on CNN, there were 3,500 heroin deaths in this one small city in Ohio this year, up from 28 last year.
Yeah. Well, this brings me to a comment by John Lennon. I guess there's nothing that anybody can do about that, but John Lennon brought up the point. He said, what is it about our society, and he's talking about America, that would lead people to want to take drugs anyway? Is prescription drug addiction as bad in other countries as it is in America? It seems to me that we... Go ahead.
It is not. I read a number about 2 years ago that astonished me. And if anyone calls with the information, I'll have to look it up again. But the number was something like this. Out of the entire world, 100% of the prescription drugs that are taken, 75% of the users come from the United States.
Oh, my God. That's horrible.
So only 25 is on the world. Yes.
You become a doctor. You're licensed to be a therapist and a counselor. Tell us about your first patient. When you were really a professional. I know that you'd been advising and helping lots of people before then, but tell me about, without mentioning the name, about the experience with your first patient, because now you're a pro and you have to, you know, you have to live up to your billing. And how was it?
My first patient, let's see. Are you talking about as far as sex and sobriety goes, I guess?
Because it was a woman. Yes.
It was a woman in her mid-50s, and she was sober for about 2 years when she came to me. And she was having a very hard, difficult time having sex because she had been a sex worker for a long time.
Oh, my goodness.
She was also a BDSM specialist, if you know what I mean.
I don't know what those initials are.
Well, it's sadomasochism.
Oh, my God.
That kind of stuff. And so she just didn't know how to have regular sex, or sex that... Not that there's anything wrong with BDSM, but she was finding that she was not enjoying it. because she had been doing it so long under the influence and pleasing everybody else. She didn't really know how to connect with somebody. So what we worked on was bringing some mindfulness awareness to herself.
Now, was she looking was she looking to enjoy sex as recreational sex or a natural release or a natural enjoyment of what nature had given her? Or was she looking for love? And is there a difference between sex when you're in love and sex for recreation?
Most of the people I've talked to agree. Because you can be in love with someone and not have great sex. And you can have great sex without any kind of emotions attached to it as well. So there is a difference. And for her, it was a process. She had never had a long-term relationship, but she wanted both. So the distinction she was able to make by being sober was there was a person that she finally fell in love with, but she was able to start enjoying having sex and was able to decide whether she wanted to just have random sex or just sex with the person that she loved. And so that's the thing. We don't know. When we have given up the one thing that has given us pleasure, and that's substances, we have to find pleasure somewhere else.
Right.
And if we're too afraid to do that, you know, what do? We may go use again. So the important thing about sex and sobriety is that you learn how to reconnect with your body, your mind, and your spirit. So that you can be present.
Have you had many men come to you, young or old, with erectile dysfunction problems?
Of course. And sometimes, you know, it depends on what drug they use, how much they used, how long they used it. But sometimes there can be some permanent damage. Now, I haven't had a person that had that kind of problem. There are also a lot of people that turn to sex as another addiction.
Oh, yes.
Once they stop using substances. And so if there is erectile dysfunction, it comes from the fear. They want to have a lot of sex, but it's scary to be with someone. So they may ejaculate prematurely, or they may not be able to get an erection.
This may sound like a rather silly question, but I presume that you met Christopher while both of you were in acting classes or in theaters or something like that. So you were active in a communal effort. But in this day and age in America, with everybody with a cell phone in his or her hand, how do men and women who need to be with each other meet each other?
Well, you know, if you're talking about sober people, they usually meet at meetings. If they're practicing a spirituality, most people are using the internet now. And so sober or not, this is how a lot of people are connecting. What I'm finding as a therapist is that there is becoming a generation of people that are socially connected with social media, but they don't have any social skills because they do not interact with each other.
Oh my goodness.
On a face-to-face level.
Oh my
gosh. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I see it all the time. As a matter of fact, I must honestly say, I never felt that I had social skills because I came from a severely dysfunctional family long before it was popular. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know people had conversation until the 1950s when I saw the Jack Parr show. And that's why I wanted to get into television, is because he actually talked to people, and I didn't know that happened. And in one respect, I envied my son the fact that he has these enormous skills. He just has them naturally, as does his mother, and obviously as you do too. I just got a message from a lady who lives in Arizona. She's 50 years of age. She says she's married to a man, 72. They're both from Iran. It was called Persia, I guess, in those days. And she claims that she loves her husband. Her husband at 72 is still sexually active, except she does not want to have sex with him, but loves him. Can a marriage like that, she wants to know, can a marriage like that be happy?
Well, I would have to talk to both of them about it. If he's in his 70s, 72?
He's 72, yes.
And she is 50?
She's 50.
Okay. I believe any relationship that communicates and has agreements with each other, understands each other's wants and needs, and are willing to compromise, accommodate, find solutions, marriages like that can survive. If he needs some kind of sex and she doesn't want to have sex with him, can she compromise on no intercourse and do something else? Will she allow him to watch porn? Is he willing to just masturbate?
You are extremely smart, because that is exactly what she actually what she says she does. And she said, you can mention my name if you want. I said, I won't. I don't want to embarrass you. But in any event, you are an extremely, extremely smart woman, and you are obviously a brilliant therapist. Tell me how you happened to write the book Sex and Sobriety, how long it took you, and how is it doing?
You know what? I haven't looked to see how it's doing. I'm just kind of astonished that I have a book. But, I had a high school education for most of my life, so it's pretty astonishing. So I'm getting used to that.
Okay, hold it quickly. I just want to throw this in. Dorothy Parker, who was part of one of the wits at the Algonquin Roundtable in the 20s, to me, she said the greatest thing about writing. She said, I hate writing, but I love having written. So that's probably
right.
you and myself. So anyway, but you probably give it to your patients.
I do give it to my clients. I am associated with a rehab in Los Angeles. It's a Buddhist recovery center, and they do a lot of mindfulness and meditation. So they have my book for their clients.
Would you like to mention
how it came?
Would you like to mention where the name of? Go ahead.
Oh, Refuge Recovery Center in Los Angeles is where the book is. You can get the book Sex and Sobriety on Amazon, or you can get it at the Dorrance Bookstore online, or you can go on my website and order it through me if you'd like. I can mail it to you.
Okay, what's your website?
Annadel at www.annadelbarber.com. Annadelbarbour.
When I Googled you, I must say there were a couple of pages full of information about you and your book. So congratulations on that. Once again,
thank you.
Tell us once again how and where they can get the book, and mention again the recovery center.
Refuge Recovery Center in Los Angeles, Amazon Books, and on the Dorrance Publishing Company, DorranceBookstore.com.
Annadel, I want to thank you so, so much for being here for a couple of reasons. First of all, I just realized that most of my guests are all male. And secondly, I'm so proud of you and your book, and you're so bright, as we've just heard just now. And you came on and you've shown my audience that I'm not a misogynist.
So, no, you're not.
I want to thank you so, so much. Give my love to my son, whom I adore, and to your sister and Tom and all of those in your family whom I adore. I miss you all. I look forward to seeing you again. And everyone, listen, sex is the driving force of nature. I've always said that nature is only interested in the three F's in life, and that is fornication, food, and fighting. And you have to fight to get the food and the fornication. That's just me. But if you go to Annadel, like Allstate, you will be in good hands. Annadel, thank you again so much. And we're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be back with the brightest newsman in America, Joe Satilli, author and creator of News Vandal. We'll be right back.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
At last.
Well, beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome Welcome back to John Barber's World. I want to thank George Knapp for that unsolicited review of The Last Word on the Assassination. But I must tell you what else George has done for me. Aside from the fact that 10 years ago he saved the Garrison tapes from obscurity and oblivion by having me on Coast to Coast on Sunday night, and I would not have part two had he not saved part one. Well, 3 days ago, George Knapp called me, brought me down to Channel 8, where he did a 45-minute interview. And I said to him, well, how on earth can you're not a film critic. You can't talk about my movie. He said, oh, yes, I can, because I'm in the media, and we're going to do a story about your film, which is so topical, because that fake news is all around America today. So sometime this week, George Knapp on Channel 8 locally will be running that. Then he will be sending it to the affiliates connected with Nexstar, which bought all the affiliates from CBS. So I have to thank him for that. And then also during the break, sometimes I wish I didn't take a break, because Joe Satilli, who is a godsend to me. Not only did he help me with the movie, but he saves me half of the time on this show and informs all of us on this show. He came on and he said Ann Adele should have her own show. So, Joe, now that you're here, welcome to the show. Tell people why somebody like Ann Adele should have her own show on BBS.
Well, you know, as she pointed out, the story she referenced was a story I had on the rundown today about a town in Ohio where the morgue is overflowing with the victims of the opioid crisis. And as she pointed out, and you asked her about it, America has a very, very severe, I always hate saying very severe, but, you know, because severe is very, but this is very severe. Addiction to prescription drugs, to non-prescription drugs, and you have a lot of people in recovery. And I think you have a lot of people in recovery who have a lot of questions about reestablishing themselves and reestablishing relationships, particularly from what I know of the book and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you're going through a process where you're trying to cleanse yourself of bad behaviors, and when you come out the other side, you need some reorientation. And, you know, John, you've listened to guys like, remember Dr. David Viscott and all of these sort of talk therapy kind of people, and they're kind of anachronisms of the end of the 20th century. I think what she has to offer is something that a lot of people would flock to like moths to the flame, because I'm sure there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, and I'm sure there are millions of them, that have questions that she could answer. I just think it's sort of the perfect time and place for it.
Well, let's see if we can make that happen for her, because I know that there are lots and lots of people who need to talk to somebody about Ann Adele. And that brings me up to something, a couple of stories in your news vandal today that I found a little disturbing and upsetting. And I guess that's why I asked her about that quote from John Lennon. What is it in American society that forces us to take these drugs and alter our perceptions of society? I remember when I was a critic in Los Angeles and I talked to a couple of very prominent actors who were alcoholics. I said, why on earth do you drink? And they said, John, you would too if you read these scripts. so that's how it's happened. But, you know, what is so difficult is we do live in a society, and we're bombarded by the negative information that comes over the news all the time. I mean, a lot of doctors and therapists say, turn off the news at least five times a week because it's too depressing. Because today is the day, the anniversary of America's bombing of Hiroshima, and yet your lead story is about some folks dreaming about a nuclear war. Tell us about that, because there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, I mean, look, the Secretary General of the UN lamented just in the last 18 hours that there are still 15,000 nuclear warheads stockpiled. And, you know, right now, North Korea is at the center of all of the angst about these things. And, you know, I think that basically North Korea is quite rational, because they learned the primary lesson of the war on Iraq, which is if you do not have weapons of mass destruction, you will be invaded. And, you know, if you have them, you probably won't be invaded. And I think that, you know, the North Korean regime is trying to preserve itself, which is why it's doing what it's doing. But then when you have Donald Trump tweeting and escalating by tweet, it does make it seem more likely that something like this could happen. Now, the United States has a series of treaties that it is supposed to be complying with, and it has been working around those. We have basically a $1 trillion upgrade of the nuclear arsenal going on right now under a thing called NIF, the National National Ignition Foundation, whatever. And it's basically what they're doing is they're saying, we're going to upgrade everything. We're not actually going to create new weapons. What we're going to do is make sure the weapons that we have work and are viable in today's environment. It's a trick to get around saying we're making new weapons, but they still want to make new weapons. And I think on some level, you know, Trump has said he would never rule out using nuclear weapons, which really did cross a line, because I think ever since the Cuban Missile Crisis, it has been kind of a sine qua non of great power policy that you say, yeah, basically nuclear weapons are off the table. It's really there purely as a deterrent. It's mutually assured destruction. We have ours, you have yours, neither of us will use it, because we both know the first person who launches will die with the person that they're targeting, with the enemy. But here's a problem that we have now. There's a thing called THAAD, THAAD. And what THAAD is it's basically a strategic missile defense that you put in a hot zone. So, for example, the United States is putting THAAD in South Korea. The United States is putting THAAD in some of the former Soviet Union satellite states, Poland, and so on. And the thing about THAAD is it's called missile defense, but really what it is it makes it possible to be offensive with your use of nuclear weapons. And here's why. Because what you can do with THAAD is, let's say you wanted to launch a first strike, you know, like the Yahoos who were all around Kennedy before he cleaned house when he learned about Operation Northwoods and he got rid of Lemnitzer and so on. These guys thought that it was possible to have a first strike against the Soviet
Union.
First of all,
tell people what Operation Northwoods was.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of them won't believe this.
No, I think your listeners will know, but if they don't know, the National Security Archive has the documents from Operation Northwoods. And Operation Northwoods was a plot that was devised by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to create a false terrorism campaign, including shooting down a drone airliner that was supposedly going to have U.S. students going to South America to do God's work. It was going to be supposedly brought down by the Cubans. There was going to be a bombing campaign supposedly by the Cubans in Miami and Washington. None of it was going to be done by the Cubans. It was going to be blamed on them. And that was going to be the predicate for an invasion of Cuba. The plan came across Kennedy's desk, and within, I think, a week, he asked for Lemnitzer's resignation, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And some people believe that this is one of those trigger events. There were many trigger events, you know. Old Jack, he was running Jack the Lad, you know what I mean? He was running afoul of the national security state. So now, you know, back then they thought, look, we'll do it. We'll have this launch, and because we have overwhelming force and we'll out-target them, the losses we'll take in response would be acceptable, but we will have defeated the communist menace. And then this idea came back in the mid-70s when George Herbert Walker Bush took control of the CIA. And the CIA's national intelligence estimate at that time said that the Soviet Union was a weak power. It could not mount a viable invasion of Western Europe. Its economy was eroding. Its unit cohesion was flagging inside the Red Army. And it was basically within 10 years or more of collapsing as a power. Well, he came in to the CIA when Ford took over. He was there for less than a year, and in addition to being one of the most active visitors of the assassination archives, he brought in something called Team B. And on Team B was a guy named Richard Pearl and another young staffer named Wolfowitz. And they rewrote the intelligence estimate to say that the Soviet Union was the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. Huh. Wonder where we've heard that before. Yeah. That the Soviet Union was within 3 to 5 years of being able to overwhelm all of Western Europe with an invasion and all the stuff. And that's when they started to come up with this idea that we have to re-entertain the idea of a first strike to take out the Pinko threat. And that's where there's this, I don't know if you ever heard of this great book by Bob Scheer called With Enough Shovels, because one of the guys who was involved in that said, with enough shovels, we can survive their retaliatory strike. In other words, everybody can go in their backyard, dig a hole, and cover themselves. If we have enough shovels, we'll make it through. So that's when Star Wars came about. And the Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, one of the reasons why the Soviets were very, very concerned is they knew that an orbiting missile defense system that could actually knock out Soviet ICBMs as they entered the atmosphere could actually make it so that the United States could launch a first strike, knock down the retaliatory strike, and end mutually assured destruction, and then make basically the whole world would be held hostage to America's nuclear might. And well, I think that's where we're coming back to again, right? That's this idea.
The thing that's so disturbing is there's nobody to really speak up with enough social power or political power to help stop what is truly madness. And as you said about Wolfowitz and Pearl, they began to do, you have what the United States does is they denigrate the enemy that is a non-existent enemy so that we begin to hate them and vilify them. Then we can justify our attack on them. You have two interesting pieces in the news, Vandal, today. And one is, I guess they want to now try to vilify North Korea. Yep. And you have this story about how there are some things in North Korea that Washington, D.C. doesn't want us to see. What could that be?
Yeah, and that's in Forbes. And that is an interesting piece by Doug Bandow. Doug Bandow is associated with the Cato Institute. He is decidedly against the U.S. empire. So there is a slant there, but it's a photo essay. And what it does is it shows you actual pictures from in and around North Korea, like at their airport and other facilities. And, you know, what the United States is being sold is that this crazy chubby cherub, evil cherub with a weird haircut is lording over this giant cult, and all of these people are constantly kowtowing to the glorious leader. Sorry, I know kowtowing is a Chinese thing, but it's going to have to work in Korea in this instance. And that they're all starving, and that it's just this crazy police state. Now, it is true, North Korea is a crazy police state, but North Korea is a rational actor. And I think this is one of the things that Doug Bandow was trying to show in this photo essay, which I highly recommend. Again, go to Forbes. And I think the title is Things That Washington Doesn't Want You to See About North Korea, something along those lines.
Go to Forbes. Go to your News Vandal.
Go to News Vandal, right. You can get me at newsvandal.com and sign up, or you can go to my Facebook page and I have it posted. So, I want to give Bandow and Forbes credit. That's one of the things about the News Vandal rundown. I want everybody who does the work to get the credit, as opposed to some websites that aggregate news and all they do is cut and paste it and they make it look like it's their own. And then the people who actually did the hard work don't get the credit. But that's a whole nother story. So you know, if you look at North Korea, I had a story on the News Vandal about 7 days ago. They're still digging up unexploded ordnance from the Korean War. And people do not realize that the Korean War has never technically come to a peace agreement. It's actually in a ceasefire. There was never a peace agreement signed. We are still in perpetual ceasefire with North Korea.
And well, so, it was never a declaration of war.
Well, the whole thing was bizarre,
police
right?
Action. They called
it was a police action with the UN. But the whole thing has never really come to any kind of completion. And it seems to me that it's logical on the part of North Korea, if it wants to preserve itself, whether or not you believe in the veracity of their leadership, The fact of the matter is that's their business, isn't it? And this is the one of the things that gets me, and I wrote a little piece about that today that's up on News Vandal about there's a story in oil price today about how the United States is facing a litmus test on how it manages the collapse of Venezuela. And I'm thinking, why does the United States have a litmus test in how it manages another country's collapse or rise for that matter? You know, somehow, John, the United States has national interests, but they're never in the United States nation. They're actually in other countries. How is it that all of our national interests are all over the place?
Well, okay, go ahead.
No. I assume that the other story that you have is about the New York Times on Russia.
Yes, absolutely. You read my mind.
Yes.
Yeah. I read News Vandal.
Well, I put those two together because, you know, it went North Korea and then Russia. And then, of course, the United States now has exercises and training in Eastern Europe, which are echoing the Cold War. And, you know, one of the things that you don't get from the New York Times is a constant reminder that Russia actually has a contracting military budget. Their budget declined by like $10 or $15 billion last year. And so their military budget is probably less than the United States spends on military actions in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, let alone the $600 billion in weaponry that's being spent to do things. And that's just the defense budget, because as you talked about the nuclear arsenal, all of the nuclear spending gets moved over to the Department of Energy. So even though we say we have a $600 billion defense budget, when you put the Department of Energy and what the Treasury does and Homeland Security and then the black budget for the CIA and all these other things, we actually have a defense budget that's like a national security budget, we should call it, of $1 trillion. And so here's Russia, which basically was gutted when Bill Clinton sent the Harvard boys over there in 1993-94. We're going to teach those Ruskies how to do economics the American way. And by doing so, they basically gutted the entire already collapsing Soviet economy. And that created the oligarchs, because it was this wild west of privatization, which actually created this massive inequality in Russia. So in many ways, the oligarchs, who many people believe have been laundering their money through people like Donald Trump and his properties here in the United States, were created by Bill Clinton and the Harvard boys in the 90s, who then turned Yeltsin into their drunken puppet. And this is actually one of the things that has caused Vladimir Putin to want to reassert Russian national identity in the wake of the humiliations of the Yeltsin-Clinton alliance.
Well, I must tell you, I know a lot of people, if they had the opportunity when they voted last, they would have written in Vladimir Putin. I'm telling you, I'm surprised. And a lot of them are very, very conservative people. Now, you have them, the New York Times, I guess it is, you know, describing how wretched a lot of the life is for the ordinary Russian now, because we have to show that Russia is really a crummy society.
That's right.
My goodness, the inequality in Russia has to now be comparable to the vast inequality in America. You could go around this country today and easily do to America with photographs and photojournalism what the New York Times is trying to do to the Soviet Union. Now, we
and John,
all know,
by the way, John, I actually follow an Instagram account, and it's a gentleman who is traveling all around the heartland of America and taking pictures of abandoned, hollowed out homes and schools and factories. And it is exactly what you were saying about, you know, what the New York Times is trying to depict in Russia. It is all across the United States. And oh, by the way, to tie back to your daughter-in-law, what she's up to, of the opioid crisis, you know, there are a lot of people who are on opioids. There are studies being done. They're basically being given opioids in lieu of things like Prozac. opioids are standing in for mood altering drugs because those are the things that are readily available to people and they're already hooked on them. And they're no longer taking opioids for pain, for physical pain. They're now taking them for emotional pain. And, you know, the stock market, Donald Trump likes to tout the stock market, 22,000. The stock market is almost irrelevant to the vast majority of the American people. Only about 40% of Americans have any stake in the stock market whatsoever. And most of the vast majority of those people have it through some 401ks that are going up and down and are subject to the vicissitudes of market interplay. But the vast majority of people have no stake, no wealth coming to them from the stock market. And oh, by the way, what's happening in the stock market is that a lot of these gains that are happening through that companies are getting, they're taking those gains and instead of paying out dividends, they're using that excess money to go buy back their own stock, thus driving up their stock prices because the CEOs and the executives at the top get paid on stock performance. So the more the stock performs, the more they pay. So they take the money that they're making off of their stock value and they're piling it back into their own stock so that it drives up the value and they make more money. It's like the ultimate Ponzi scheme.
But yeah, it is a Ponzi scheme, and you know, it has nothing to do with money as far as I'm concerned. I knew a half a dozen mega millionaires in Hollywood and their orgasm was not money. Their orgasm was power.
Yeah,
well. That's their orgasm. Anyway, Joe, thank you again. Tell the folks once again where they can get your news, Vandal, and when are you going to do Chuck's show again?
I'll be on Chuck tomorrow night from 6 to 7. You just go to newsvandal.com. And folks, go over to Amazon, John Barber, Second Assassination. It's hot stuff. It's doing really well. What's the price point before you go?
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
How much is it? How much is it to
it's
rent?
It's only $1.99.
So folks, get there and go watch it. It's really worth it.
Thank you so much, Joe, very much. I want to thank Don and Doug Newsom. And I couldn't do this show without the extraordinary help of my producer, Mike Kim. And as Ed Murrow used to say when he signed off, good luck and good night. And boy, do we need some good luck. Good night.
A sunny, 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 I love you.